You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the US versus China trade war appears to be on, at least until Donald Trump gets distracted by something else. My guests Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Israel's rejection of any international investigation into Friday's shootings on its frontier with Gaza, the launch of the BBC's new Serbian service, and how far would you go to watch a football match? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, London Evening Standard's defence editor, and Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and broadcaster. Welcome both. And we will start with China's apparent determination to test the proposition of US President Donald Trump that trade wars are good and easy to win. In response to Trump's decision to apply tariffs on steel and aluminium imports to the United States, China has stuck 25% on 128 American products, including various food produce, wine, and rolled steel bars. The US is also believed to be planning further tariffs on Chinese imports in retaliation for China's decades of taking liberties with intellectual property. Michael, first of all, how do we like America's chances of winning this trade war?
Well, this is where it gets to be beyond my competence, Andrew, because there's a lot to be, as I understand it, if you are the debtor, if you're the one with the imbalance, it's kind of like when if the bank has lent you $1 million and you can't pay it back, it's really the bank's problem. What can they do to you? And because of the imbalance so favors China, it is if it's going to be a real trade war instead of, as you say, our ADHD president, suddenly changing his mind and changing his policy. I think that it's hard to see America winning in the long run, because it's not just a trade war in the traditional sense. This is a geopolitical situation in which the emerging economy, that is China, I mean, China's emerged, but it's now beginning to increasingly use its economic power to become a geopolitical player. It had always stepped back, and I just think that if America thinks it can fight back this way, I don't know. But, what's interesting, and, the Chinese are not stupid. The one thing that what did they choose today? We were talking about slapping tariffs on products. What did they choose? Robert Fox on the other side of the table is grinning because he knows what I'm going to say. They chose pork products. Now, I would never have thought that the Chinese actually needed to import pork products. They have a lot of pigs of their own. And pork is a major part of their diet. But, where does pork come from? Iowa.
Yeah.
Iowa backs Trump. Where do all of these farm goods come from?
This is in much the same way, of course, the EU stuck tariffs on bourbon whiskey and Harley Davidson motorcycles and Levi's jeans.
Exactly, from the South. And, it's not, America is vulnerable. And more than that, no, I shouldn't say America. Trump is vulnerable, His base is located in these places. If they begin to suffer, exports begin to drop. Futures of crops to feed these pigs begin to drop. He may very quickly decide, this wasn't the best idea I ever had, and reverse course. He's perfectly capable of it.
Robert, does it strike you that Donald Trump knows where he is going with this, or is this just another example of an idea popping into his head and him just deciding to act on it?
He did talk about it a bit when he was promising to bring all those jobs back in the election campaign.
This is true.
And this is a gut item. And one thing that is consistent about him is that he believes in his guts. And this is why we get the firing of H.R. McMaster and hiring somebody far more kindred spirits like Pompeo and John Bolton. He believes his rhetoric. He's like Henry VIII. He believes the last thought or thoughtette that came into his head in the last few seconds. So that, let's have a go at, I've got to help these steel workers. Let's have a go at China. China is of such a complexity, as Michael has explained, that I don't think they're beginning to grip it. There are three immediate things with China that he's got to grasp. He's got himself into an unfortunate, he really does look as if he's got himself into a trade war. He has got North Korea. And the North Korea choreography, whether there is a meeting or not, he's probably going to look bad because it is being run, and I would think, quite beautifully and slyly and subtly by Beijing. That was the message when the young leader went in the sparkly old train, armored train, for the meeting, because the mood music there, the way the Chinese bigged it up, it was a message not only to South Korea and the US, but to the world. We're in charge of this one, and we will see it through. I just don't think there's been any preparation there. And the other thing that we tend to forget, that Trump tends to get silly about from time to time, is the South China Sea. And the South China Sea, as you would say in Australia, it's atoll, it's one atoll after another. But they've been building out there. And so Trump is apprised of this quite recently. What does he do? He runs a sort of mini US battle fleet flotilla through the South China Sea, which actually, that kind of gesture politics doesn't mean anything. The Chinese are waiting for him. One final thought, and I'm sorry, I don't want to hog the airwaves, is of course China does know it owns a hell of a lot of the U.S. debt.
And which goes back to my point about when you owe the bank $1 million, it's the bank's problem. But just to add in, on this particular thing, we can also extrapolate. The fact is he's fired McMaster. He's firing everyone who disagrees, who brings a differing point of view than his gut tells him. And his trade representative, who he appointed in the original cabinet, is a former academic called Peter Navarro, who has been writing about, you know, the way the Chinese are raping the American economy and it's time for a trade war, and no, you won't get hurt if you do it. And, you know, McMaster is gone, Peter Navarro is still there. And I think that we have to understand that as year two of the Trump regime expands into infinite space, that he's increasingly surrounded by yes people. And I think that that also affects the decision-making in the Oval Office.
Okay, well, let's look now at Israel, which has today rejected calls by both the EU and the UN for an investigation of Friday's shootings along Israel's frontier with Gaza. 16 Palestinians are now known to have been killed and hundreds more injured after Israeli soldiers opened fire on demonstrations. Israel claims that at least 10 of the dead were associated with Hamas or other militant organizations. Hamas has admitted that 5 were members of its paramilitary wing, the Izzad-Din al-Qassam Brigades. Robert, first of all, Israel's Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman says that all Israel's troops involved in the operations deserve a commendation. Has Israel satisfactorily made that case?
No. I've been coming through the English language Israeli press today, and it's very interesting. They're very, very divided. Same newspapers, obviously the lead of the sort of the liberal internationalist wing in the media is Haaretz. But Haaretz has had one piece, balance it again, justifying what happened. And it's simply a hysterical piece, which seems to make no sense whatsoever. Because the claim is that this demonstration, which happens quite regularly, by the way, at this time of the year, because it's called Land Day, and it commemorates the death of 6 Palestinians in 1976 or thereabouts, in this period, over land disputes with Israel around the Strip. So let's clear that away.
Well, but it's an important point that this was not a spontaneous occurrence. Everybody knew this demonstration was occurring.
Right. And that's right. The Israelis would have known too. That's the interesting point, because you're quite right to cite Lieberman and this kind of my Israeli Defense Force right or wrong approach, which we're getting in the press today, say this was a concerted plan attack they're now trying to big it up as, where 40,000 Palestinians were going to try and breach the fence and invade Israel, of which I see not an iota of proof. The fact is that these people were shot down by sharpshooters too. It wasn't just Israeli conscripts pooping off and losing rather control of the situation. As far as I can see, Andrew, and I think this is the case that the Israeli command and government have to answer to, this was aimed fire. at least in some of the cases. And of course, when you say that, yes, they could be Hamas military, but for God's sake, Hamas is the elected government and it runs, has been running that place since 2007. And this idea that it is illegitimate, it's a thing that Tony Blair curiously went along with. And all of us were saying to Blair, you've arranged democratic elections in the Palestinian territories, Ramallah, the West Bank, as well as Gaza, you've got to stick with the result. And there's an absolutely schizoid approach to what is going on in Gaza. I'd like to talk more, but not, we must hear what Michael's got to say, about the deep situation in Gaza, which is ghastly and terrifying, and the Israelis are refusing to acknowledge.
All that said, Michael, is there any reason to suppose that Hamas will have been other than delighted with what occurred on Friday?
No. I mean, I think that this plays into... You know, first of all, we sit here and we judge. Let's remember that the way it's looked at between the participants is, you know, nobody likes us and we don't care. That's the Israeli view. And, you know, and Hamas-led Gaza says, we give up our bodies. We want to create martyrs to maintain an emotional connection to our electorate. And it's impossible to judge and say in normal terms this kind of action. Clearly, the Israeli government could have handled this in an entirely different way. And frankly, Hamas, if it wants to make a point about the right of return, could have gone the full Gandhi, if you know what I mean. Meanwhile, this, you know, we're coming up on a very important holiday in 6 weeks in Israel. Actually, it's 2 weeks in Israel because they celebrate it on the lunar calendar. It's 70 years since the establishment of the State of Israel. This is going to lead to a huge amount of commentary. And it's 50 plus years since the occupation started. On the day this event happened, 16 people killed. We've seen the picture, some of them kids. On that very same day, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, was in New York at Goldman Sachs, and there are pictures of him enjoying a cup of coffee with Lloyd Blankfein. The world has changed. This conflict doesn't change. That's my point. I'm sorry to have gone off on a tangent. But, you know, it does aggravate, you know, we sit here and we think, well, where's the logic? There is no logic. The world has changed in logical ways. It's more important for Saudi Arabia to have an ally in Israel to confront Iran and to confront what Iran is doing on the northern border of Israel, which is, you know, backing Assad and winning that war, as we're finding out today. I mean, Assad may be in the end game now. And, you know, and meanwhile, down at the fence, Hamas is sending innocent people out. Some of them, anyway. I mean, yeah, of course, there are Hamas militants trying to get into Israel to create mayhem. But there are kids in the crowd as well. And Hamas says, doesn't care if they get killed because they think the world will come and rescue them. The world is not going to come and rescue them. Mohammed bin Salman's in New York doing business.
On that, well, to follow that point up, Robert, this has been one of the reasons I've always massively admired correspondents who can keep reporting that region day in, day out, week in, week out, year in, year out, and so forth. I've reported from there in intermittent bursts. I've been to Israel, the West Bank a few times, Gaza once, but even that limited amount, it's exactly as Michael says. You go there several years apart and get exactly the same quotes from exactly the same people. It does not move. And this, if we focus that thought on this particular situation, there's 6 weeks of these protests scheduled to occur. If there is a similar demonstration next Friday, what options, or what better options, should the Israelis perhaps embrace?
Well, I don't think they're going to, so I think that we can park that. Where I absolutely agree with you, and I don't want to get into perpendicular pronoun country and the autobiography, you know, it gets a bit tedious. It's moving. Actually, that is the lie about this, because you're quite right. The Israeli narrative is precisely, and I'm not saying that you're doing, that look, this used to be an international dispute in the Cold War, then it became a big regional dispute. Now it's just a domestic dispute because our best allies on the other side, namely Saudi Arabia and, do not forget, Egypt as well, just want to shut the whole thing off. But think of the Yemen factor, the humanitarian factor. Gaza doesn't stand still. When I first started reporting Gaza, the population was around 600,000. It's heading before the end of this decade to 2 million. The conditions are absolutely appalling. After the last absolutely open contest in 2014 between Israelis and Gaza, the UN agencies went and looked at it, and the UN Development Report said the following. They are running out of water. The infrastructure is collapsing unless you can rebuild it. By 2020, it will not be able to sustain itself, and you will have to go elsewhere. The water supply is polluted. The electricity and power supply is intermittent. You're lucky if you get 4 or 5 hours. And the sewage is in the streets. It is an utterly intolerable situation. The Israelis are aware of it, and they shrug their shoulders. You know, we would allow them to use our reverse osmosis plants and bring fresh water into it. It's very gestural, but at least the humanitarians really do understand this. They cannot afford to let this place implode slash explode, which it's going to do within 2 years. And that's why history doesn't stand still. It's really moving, but it's moving in a way where the combination of circumstances like Yemen, which is another absolutely wicked problem, which I think where we correspondents and commentators are absolutely failing to get it across, because suddenly it blows up and it becomes a major area of dispute, confrontation, conflict.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree entirely with Robert on that. I mean, this is going to be very controversial, but I do think that too many people in Israeli politics think like Avigdor Lieberman. It's one of the things that keeps Bibi Netanyahu kind of propped up with his 19 Likud members of the Knesset, but it's the largest bloc on the right. Mm-hmm. They don't care.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so long as it doesn't come through that fence, you know, they can go elsewhere. You know, it is a not uncommon thing, and this goes back to even the days when Oslo seemed to be a possibility, that there was a strong strain. It says, the Arabs have their country. It's called Jordan. They can go to Egypt. This is our country. We want it by conquest. They don't care. And unless that 2 million figure really does turn into some extraordinarily violent thing, I don't see that it will change, Robert.
Okay, I do very quickly, because I think Israeli politics are a lot more fragmented than we are perhaps giving the impression of here. And I think that that is very worrying. I don't think that this bloc can, they haven't got a lock on it forever. The little bloc you were describing.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, Belgrade Calling.
The pendulum is a swinging, and these days it's the city of Paris that's turning heads with retail innovation. Monocle Films traveled to the 16th arrondissement to sample Le Bon Marché's new addition to La Grande Épicerie family.
Food is a lot of memory. It's memory with your mother, with your grandmother. Food, it's a pleasure. You have to find this game with a product. I try in the architecture to have this sensibility.
For a filmic tour of La Grande Épicerie, Rive Droite, head to monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb. Serbian-speaking fans of the BBC can now consume the Beeb's digital output in their own language. BBC News Serbian may be found at bbc.com/Serbian and is the latest in a recent series of expansions which have added 12 new languages to the corporation's online output, including Korean, Amharic, Punjabi, Gujarati and West African Pidgin. Robert, first of all, Does the BBC still have the potence as a brand that it used to have in the pre-online world outside the UK? It used to be very common, as I'm sure you experienced, that people in places whose local media was a bit less trustworthy perhaps would believe things once they'd heard it on the world service.
It was, you know, the gold standard. One will go and see a leader, in brackets, dictator or other, and he would say, but I heard it on the BBC. And I got into terrible trouble once for broadcasting from Saudi Arabia in the World Service of the BBC, for whom I was working, amongst others at that time, and told I was, you know, I hadn't applied for the right visa to do this. But it was quite clear that everybody was listening to it. I think since the analog world has died, probably, it doesn't have the same power. What I think would be open to question is whether it has the same credibility in the world of social media. I think it does. I think it does have a lot. And I think that this is the BBC and the government, UK government, have said this is an exercise in soft power. No, it isn't. Since we're all keen, I know you love new bits of geopolitical jargon. It's an exercise naked in sharp power. Because you rightly, that list was impressive. There were minority areas. There are areas like Nepal that they want to get into for obvious political reasons, West Africa. But Serbia becomes very interesting by this criterion. And they're going to both Gujarati and Punjabi. Of course, that has big reference to large representations of those populations within the UK population. But Serbia is really, really interesting because it's toe-to-toe with Russia, and it's absolutely clear that that's what's going on.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is I spent quite a bit of my life going to Bush House, which used to be the headquarters of the World Service, and the NPR Bureau was situated there, and there was a Serbo-Croat service, kind of disappeared. In fact, many of the language services disappeared because, you know, there's this element in the story which, you know, Serbia is interesting, but it's also a classic story of inept British government bureaucracy. What happened was about 7 years ago, last time they renewed the charter, the World Service had always been paid for by the Foreign Office, up to the tune of about $250 million. Yes, more
something
than
something more, I think.
So, you know, it's 250 million quid, a quarter of a billion quid a year. And at the last charter renewal, the then director general, in the space of about a half an hour, said, okay, we'll take it on. We'll take on the cost of the World Service out of our budget. And so they cut right, left, and center. And they said, in this day and age of digital, do we even need to be projecting our power this way? It's very colonial. And they cut back all the language services. And now the news, of course, is that they are restoring these services again because they've clearly identified that there's a need for it. And also because the Foreign Office has started kicking back some of the money that was taken away from them. You know, so that's a kind of typical bureaucratic story of the BBC.
It's actually very nearly and £250 million.
It was £250 million.
They put back in.
Yeah. And I've asked for more money for my next BBC World Service documentary because they've got bigger budgets now and they're going to bump me up by a whole 1,500 quid on the fee they're giving me, which is really cool. I need the money. So anyway, but you know, but it's funny, but Robert is absolutely right. Because Serbia now is clearly, it's a very important node in the West's new Cold War. It's not the West's. It's the West and Russia's new competition for dominance in Central Europe. Serbia is seen as a place that needs, I think, to have a more independent of Russian viewpoints kind of media, and hence we have this starting up again.
I mean, Robert, just a final thought on this one, and specifically focusing on Serbia as a prize that may be wrestled over between the West and Russia. How important is it?
It's a lot more important than we're getting because there's a lot of aggravation with Kosovo. Kosovo is not very settled. The Russians were accused of doing terrible things around 2 years ago in Montenegro, which is very much the sort of the appendix to Serbia, trying to murder the prime minister. No, in the new world, the new sharp power world of contestation, it's the cold contestation we're seeing that's going on. It is very, very important indeed. And there's another area. I don't want to go on through the catalogue, but of course, Bosnia is terribly, terribly difficult. The three-way split is going on. And the real awfulness, I'm sure you were both there at the time in the terrible breakup wars of the dissolution of Yugoslavia, there was one winner generically, and it was organized crime, big time. And that's one of the reasons why regional powers like the Italians, the French, the Spanish, the Germans, the Austrians say you must do something to get a grip on this because it's an absolutely free fire zone for that. And of course, poor old Serbia has been left behind because it's been a dumping ground for the refugees that nobody wants coming across the Mediterranean and from the east through Turkey.
OK, well, finally tonight, a big shout-out to any listeners we may have among the hardcore travelling support of FC Baltika Kaliningrad, currently fourth in Russia's National Football League, the country's second-tier professional competition. They are currently recovering from what must be the longest away trip in any domestic sports competition to Luch Vladivostok, at the other end of Russia, 10,000 kilometres or 12 hours by air away, or about a week each way by train, if you really want to plan in advance. The game ended nil all, and that did prompt us. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's just there's something wondrously Russian about that. You spend 12 hours on domestic Russian airlines as well in order to watch a nil all game in Vladivostok. And I suppose Vladivostok have it all to do for the return leg. But we did want to ask you, what was the furthest either of you have ever travelled or would travel, I guess, to watch a sporting event? And just to establish a benchmark here, not that I wish to be pointlessly competitive, the figure to beat is my own record of London to Melbourne for the 2011 grand final between Geelong and Collingwood, which Geelong did win. However, I do not wish to enter into discussions about this morning's game against Hawthorn.
The farthest I've travelled in recent decades is the 2.5 miles from my front door to the Prince George Public House, where, because I can't afford to go to matches anymore of any sort.
Which team would you be watching at the Prince George Public House?
The Prince George is a great pub, and you'll never find it. You'd need to contact me because it's one of these pubs in a residential road. You wouldn't know about it. It was run by this very garrulous Scotsman who'd lived in South Africa most of his working life and came back to run the pub, and he was an enormous rugby fan. Rugby Union, as am I. And to go and watch Six Nations play, and it wasn't one team we supported. We were of the anyone but England 15 type. And of course, the pub was full of Guardian readers because it's in London Fields. And Guardian readers, as you know, are not terribly patriotic, except when it comes to the England rugby team. And they all become, you know, like Hooray Henrys of the worst
sort.
They're
all public schoolboys, aren't they?
Yes, Robert. Yes, exactly. And so that was like going on a great adventure to stand with my Scottish publican friend. And he bought, because he owned the place, he bought the drinks. And we smoked tiny cigars and rooted for whoever was beating England. That was as far as I got.
But what we've clearly learnt there is that I still win because
I'm advancing
London to Melbourne and you've come up with walking around the corner. Robert, do you have a bid for second place at least? Have you travelled further than around the corner to watch a sporting fixture?
I've been taken, although I was in country at the time, I've been taken to Turin. A long time ago, for an England-Italy quarter-final in the
1990 World Cup,
I went to the wrong entrance, although I was invited by the Rai broadcaster and spoke in choice Italian. How knackered the English team was, and they didn't deserve to win anything, much in the Michael Goldfarb tradition. But I nearly got stuck into a knife fight, not of my own choosing, and I had to have. It was the Polizia di Stato. They were very, very kind and encouraging. They said, "You silly fool, you went to the wrong place." So come with us.
Robert Fox, who survived 2 tours in Gaza and 10 in Bosnia, knifed to death at an England quarterfinal.
Yeah. Well, on that heartening note of a lucky escape, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Robert Fox and Michael Goldfarb, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researched by Tom Melville. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music next at 1900, the debut of the new look Monocle Culture Show with Rob Bound, and more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Millett. Thank you for listening.